Well, good morning. This is Per Fagerang, Fight the Empire. And our guest is Norman Solomon, the syndicated columnist, author. I think his last book was Made Love Got War, but maybe there's been something since then. Norman, are you there?
I am. Hi, Per.
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing okay in this time of, what's the name of the show? Empire.
Fight the Empire. Or Fooey on the Empire, or whatever you want. Anyway, you... The IOU, tell us about the California budget crisis. I hear Governor Arnold declared a state of fiscal emergency. And have the IOUs been issued yet?
You know, I haven't checked the wires this morning, but it's really been a state of ideological emergency by any other name. You know, I was thinking of a statement by a German sociologist who said the budget is a skeleton of the state, stripped bare of all misleading ideologies.
Oh, boy.
And there we are. I mean, the way that the money is collected and the way that it's spent really tells us where the power is, unfortunately, in our state, in our country, in our world. And whether you're in California or Oregon or whether you're talking about budget expenditures for Afghanistan, where 90% of the new supplemental is going for military means, despite the rhetoric about, oh, we know this is not a military problem. It tells you a lot. So, you know, in California, I would just sort of trace this back to a refusal to tax corporations like Chevron at their fair share, freezing in property taxes with Prop 13 back in the 1970s. And so a lot of people in political office are now in a position of being told, you get to figure out what to cut. And, you know, whether it's the Multnomah County Commission or whether it's in the state of Oregon, you have all these elected officials. Many of them, I think, want to do good things. They are interested in helping people, and yet they're ending up just cutting budgets.
Well, from what I read, they've decimated just about every humane service there is. Is there anything left?
Yeah, I mean, in California, the state has on the drawing boards just all sorts of, I think the popular but appropriate word is draconian cuts. And so you have people who are depending on health care for children. You have education. You have preschool. You know, just you can go across the line. Everything that we've come to, if not expect, at least think there will be a significant amount of, is now on the chopping block. And I think one reason it's hard to answer where things are in terms of the cuts is it's been a moving target. In February, you know, after I think it was 100 days or so of at times round-the-clock legislative meetings in Sacramento, the state of California, through the Assembly and the State Senate, enacted basically a plan. It was the grand plan, and literally, Per, I'm not exaggerating, there were five people in the room who decided what it would be. You know, they were going to cut the Gordian knot, that it couldn't be solved legislatively. And, you know, long story short, while there's a Democratic Party majority in the legislature, the state constitution requires two-thirds passage for budget measures for to raise taxes and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so it means that because the Republicans had more than a third, they could basically block any sort of semi-rational approach. So after so much frustration and time going by and the clock ticking and the debt mounting to something like $44 billion on the horizon, these five people cut a deal and then said, okay, you know, this is where we're going to cut. We're going to put these ballot measures out for the voters on May 19th, and this is the deal that we've made. It was all going to work out, except the voters soundly rejected it. The Republicans and the right wing put a spin on that people rejected it because they didn't want new taxes of any sort or new spending. But the reality is polling shows a lot of the opposition was because of, in effect, spending caps. And if I'm remembering correctly, there was going to be sort of a five-year rolling average that then would say, okay, you've got to cap spending at this level. It was a way to sort of straitjacket anything, to mix metaphors, approximating a solid safety net. And so now that that's been rejected, you know, we're back to what you alluded to, the governor talking about IOUs and moving in that, you know, to that direction because the state can't pay, you know, some of its basic bills. And one more thing I would add here is that Schwarzenegger has, you know, a bit of a reputation for being a libertarian or environmentalist around some issues. But there's a lot of indication that he's a devotee of the Milton Friedman school, and he's actually quite right-wing in terms of economic policy, and he has tap-danced and sort of tried to reposition himself. But this guy believes in shredding the state expenditures when there are times to tighten the belt, shred them for low-income, moderate-income people. So it's basically, you know, not to be rhetorical here, but it's about a war on the middle class and especially war on low-income people.
Well, I heard, maybe I read it wrong, that they're just about going to eliminate welfare entirely. Is that true?
Well, there's a lot of talk about it, yeah. And I'm just tentative about it in part because this has been shifting so much. But what hasn't shifted is that the people who will bear the brunt of this are below the medium income. People are just being savaged in terms of, you know, Medicaid, what's called Medi-Cal in California, is already just a mess where try to find a provider, good luck, is quite often the problem, especially if you need a primary care provider or, you know, a specialist or that sort of thing. This is looking to get a lot worse. And, you know, I think if we step back, and no state is really immune from this, it's just most extreme because California is so big and it's such a big mess in California and been particularly irresponsible for the failure to raise taxes and so forth. But I think, you know, you step back, and this is part of a long-range consequence of refusing to have equitable taxation so that the burden has been lifted from the very wealthy and from huge corporations.
How long has that two-thirds rule been around? You say it's in the Constitution, but when was it always in the Constitution?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but it's been a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And Democrats are identifying it, and in part, I think quite accurately, and in part as kind of a scapegoat because they won't fight back sufficiently. The two-thirds rule has been identified as the problem, and there are efforts now to get on the ballot next year. And I don't know the current status, but to either require a 55 instead of 67% through the legislature or even a majority. But, you know, there is this sort of pseudo-populist driven from upper income call for not raising taxes. And, of course, that's been emblematic across the country. So it sort of fuels this idea that the two-thirds rule has to be kept in place.
Well, maybe painting you with too broad a brush, but my impression is that the Republicans want no new taxes, but they want to keep spending money on the military. The Democrats, they do want new taxes, but they don't bring up the military budget either. And so that is just kind of left there. It's not talked about very much. Does anybody say anything about that in California?
Well, you have certain people such as Congresswoman Barbara Lee or Lynn Woolsey.
We can always count on them, I suppose. But, I mean, like among the mainstream people, you know, the movers and shakers.
The center of the party, the Democratic Party, is saying very little. Back years ago, the argument was that the president was a Republican and there wasn't enough power in Congress to raise these questions. Ron Dellums, of course, used to raise these questions in Congress. Peter DeFazio, and I know some of our listeners right now, Per, are from Eugene, Southern Willamette Valley, who have Peter DeFazio on their ballot, longtime progressive Democrat. This is an issue that Peter DeFazio has talked about for a very long time, how crazy it is to be spending so much money on the military. Well, lo and behold, a couple of weeks ago, when the vote came up, the final vote on the supplemental bill, about $100 billion for more war in Iraq and Afghanistan, Peter DeFazio voted for that money. There were 32 Democrats, as I recall, who voted against it in the final vote. DeFazio voted for it. Now, he, by his own account, says that he got a five-minute phone call from Rahm Emanuel while this vote was pending about whether he should vote yes or no. And Rahm Emanuel, of course, chief of staff of the Obama White House, told him, according to DeFazio, about the Obama administration's plans for a future waging of, by any other name, quote, the war on terror. And after that conversation, by his own account, Peter DeFazio voted to escalate the war in Afghanistan and talk about money, about pouring more money into it. So the question comes up, and you know, you would know more about this in terms of the voting record pair of Blumenauer and other folks in the House. But in the case of, you have the most liberal district in the state, arguably, certainly the Eugene constituency for DeFazio. If this guy's voting for more war, what will it take for people to mobilize and develop a primary challenge against this guy in the Democratic primary in 2010? And one might ask the same thing about Blumenauer.
That's a good question.
I think I have an answer.
Okay.
We have the opportunity, but we don't have sufficient grassroots infrastructure and determination to do it. And I think there's a multiplicity of reasons, and not to go on about it, but here too. One is that some folks think, well, it's a Democrat, so we're not going to fight in the Democratic primary. And then some folks think that they're just above doing electoral politics inside the Democratic Party. And I think they're both wrong at this historical juncture. It's very hard to do many things that grassroots progressives do all the time, operating independent radio stations, of which there are too few, but KBOO's one of the precious ones, doing all sorts of independent websites, community centers, organizing projects. We can do this sort of thing if we focus, but we have to be willing to do the hard work.
Well, yeah, I know people who do that kind of, you know, they work within the Democratic Party, and I respect them. I like their ideas, and I wish them the success. You know, I think everybody's going to do what they feel comfortable with. But getting back to that call from Rahm Emanuel, he talked to DeFazio for about 5 minutes, and he outlined President Obama's war on terror, or his upcoming war on terror, and DeFazio changed his mind? Is that how it goes?
That's the narrative from DeFazio himself. The one way I would sort of amend that is he said he was on the fence,
mm-hmm.
and then he got the call, so he hadn't decided which way to vote by his account. This was reported in McClatchy News Service, and I quoted in a piece I wrote. It's posted on normansolomon.com, but I quote from the McClatchy News Service account. So, yeah, that's what DeFazio said happened. And I think, frankly, quite often we progressives, we give people a pass. I mean, there are issues and issues. People will not always agree. But when there's a vote to appropriate, to escalate war in Afghanistan, this is like one of the key votes that we could point to in 1965 to appropriate more money for the Vietnam War. And so people need to decide, you know, how serious are we about challenging that sort of policy?
You know, I know Rahm Emanuel can be very kind of, quote, persuasive. Is there any indication what he said Obama's war on terror is going to be like? I mean, specifically what he had in mind?
We don't know, but we do know that the White House, including Rahm Emanuel, made a lot of calls that week to members of Congress. And in the piece I mentioned, which actually was titled Obama and Anti-War Democrats, that I wrote at this time, where I talked about DeFazio's vote and the backstory, I also talked about how the White House went to first-term Democrats who are considered to be the most intimidatable, if that's a word, and also the most vulnerable to be reelected.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, if you don't vote for this supplemental appropriation for war in Afghanistan, you cannot count on Obama's support come 2010. This is a Democratic Party White House talking to Democrats who are already in Congress. And who is in that category? Somebody like Donna Edwards from Maryland, very progressive new member of Congress, Eric Massa up in upstate New York around Rochester, several others who then went ahead and voted against anyway. So they, I'll be, you know, blunt here. Here's first-term members of Congress who had more guts to withstand the pressure from the White House than somebody who has a totally safe district in Eugene and beyond, namely DeFazio.
So it looks like the White House is willing to sort of really kind of diminish his own party just to get this war spending passed.
Well, the arms were twisting very aggressively, and I'm afraid that there may be this dynamic similar to the mid-1990s where the president has fairly high popularity, but by not really being able to go out there or willing to go out there and promote a program and a position that or an array of positions that make sense to people and really argue for it, Congress is left dangling. And we know what happened in 1994. Well, 2 years later, Clinton sailed through getting reelected, but Congress was in Republican hands. And so it depends on what kind of president or White House we're going to have. And then just to sort of step back to the big picture that you were alluding to, U.S. military spending is now $2 billion, that's billion with a B, $2 billion a day out of the U.S. Treasury for the military. Meanwhile, we're being told, and California is an example, that no matter how much distress a state is in, the Obama administration is not willing to give aid to the states. And you know, you go back and you look at what FDR did early on in the New Deal. Unlike the Republican rhetoric, he wasn't some sort of raving Marxist. He was somebody who was more willing to say, here's a problem, we're going to challenge those that FDR called the economic royalists, and we're going to create new programs, not just as the Obama administration, putting at the top of the corporate system, and some of it will filter down, but actually creating public works programs where the government is the employer. You know, we're not seeing this. And lest anybody think I'm some sort of anti-Obama person, you know, I'm not. I was elected as an Obama delegate to the Democratic National Convention. I'm glad that we have a President Obama, not a President McCain. And when people on the left have said to me, you know, gee, you know, aren't you sorry you worked for Obama? I don't think so. I talk to progressive audiences. I haven't found one person yet who says they'd just as soon have President McCain as President Obama. But that doesn't get us off the hook as progressives. We've got to organize and challenge from a progressive direction.
Well, we are talking with Norman Solomon, syndicated columnist and author, about the California budget mess and war spending. The war budget, I guess, is way over $600 billion a year, and that's huge. And the California, I read that the California budget deficit is $24 billion, which is big, but that is equal to the cost of 12 B-2 stealth bombers.
It tells you a lot. I discovered a wonderful website. If people want to Google it, it's simply National Priorities Project. It's wonderful because it's so accurate and acute, but it's really giving us pretty horrifying information exactly along the lines that you're mentioning. When you go to an average-sized county, for instance, I looked up Sonoma County in California, and certainly it's no larger than Multnomah County, I don't think. And you type in the numbers, you find that that county has had $1.6 billion from its taxpayers, again with a B, $1.6 billion from the county taxpayers to the IRS that then directly went to pay for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then you think, you know, if you could rewind the tape like in a Twilight Zone or a Superman comic, and you go back and you say, let's imagine that this didn't happen. Or another way to put it, somebody shows up to the Multnomah County Commissioners or the Board of Supervisors in Sonoma County and says, you know, you're going to get a refund for all the money that people in this county sent to the IRS for these wars, going back to 2001 for Afghanistan, 2003 for Iraq. Here's a check for $1.6 billion. Can we imagine what it could do in Portland or in Sonoma County to have $1.5 billion? I mean, it's unfathomable. When you cost it out, that amount of money could pay for the health care of 650,000 people for a full year. And since the counties are smaller than that, another way to think of it is the money could pay all the health care for 65,000 people for each of the next 10 years.
Well, we just one of the big stories in today's news, it's really not in the paper even that much, is the all of a sudden, I think they landed 4,000 troops in part of Afghanistan, this big push is going on in Helmand Province.
Yeah.
And it's already one soldier has been captured. And I guess these the troops, this time the strategy, they say it's different, but it doesn't seem different to me, is they are intending to just kind of stay. They're not going to try and just hit the Taliban and leave. They're just intending to stay in little outposts, and it seems to me that's been tried before.
Yeah.
So I just wonder where all this is leading. It's you know, it would seem to me, you know, jumping ahead, that the empire cannot afford guns and butter. You know, LBJ showed that back in the 60s.
Well, he showed it, and at the time, Martin Luther King said, you can talk about guns and butter all you want, but when you spend so much on guns, you don't even get good oleo.
There you go.
For those who don't remember back that far, oleo meant oleomargarine.
Right, the little red buttons that you had to break up and squeeze in the plastic bag.
And so in the process of all these escalations that go on, not only incrementally, but now we're seeing a huge jump, we have really not only the money that's being spent, but also the soldiers coming back. And, of course, whether it's 6 months or 2 years from now, soldiers will be back home. Those who are able to survive the war, the vast majority of them, many of them, though, come back with injuries, physical injuries, and even more with PTSD and a lot of suffering for them and their families, which compounds then the problem back home because the budgets have been shredded in terms of taking care of people. And I think this all the more makes it urgent, you know, that we mobilize. And it gets back to my comment. It's not that I have anything personally against Blumenauer or DeFazio or anybody else. Just we expect and should demand more from them. And at the grassroots, we've got to raise these issues. It's been said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes an awful lot. And I can remember sitting in the KABU studios on Southeast Belmont in 1972 and 1973, and we were talking about the continuation of the Vietnam War. And in point of fact, even after it technically ended in early 1973, the bombing continued, and the U.S. Continued to fund the South Vietnamese government to be bombing and strafing. And so this is not something that can be solved just because we have a Democrat in the White House or that we like the rhetoric coming from the Oval Office.
Well, you know, even President Eisenhower, he put it very clearly. He said that every dollar that goes for weapons is a dollar taken away from schools or health care or all these other humane services. There it is. I mean, I think the politicians like to say, well, you know, we're state officials and this is a federal issue but it's the same taxpayer who funds it all.
This is where leadership really comes in, because there are parts of the country where there's more of a tendency for people to raise these issues and have their concerns and outlook reflected by elected officials. And, of course, during the Vietnam War, a great example being Wayne Morse, the senior senator from Oregon, who, beginning in 1964 at the time of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, spoke up. He spoke up in 65, 66, 67, and 68. Lyndon Johnson, as president, although they were in the same party, grew to despise him. And then the White House, I think, didn't mind when, after a vicious campaign in the primary by what we now would call a blue dog Democrat, and then from the historic non-entity Bob Packwood in the fall of 1968, Wayne Morse was defeated. But his voice and his example were tremendously prophetic and powerful in the long run. And I want to mention, Per, that people who would like to see footage of Wayne Morse, which is just absolutely galvanizing, to see him on television in 1964, we included that in the documentary that was adapting my book, War Made Easy. And I know a lot of people are now on Netflix, so you can get it without charge. You just go to Netflix and type in War Made Easy, War Made Easy on Netflix. You'll get the film. And Wayne Morse, as well as Barbara Lee, a modern contemporary or a parallel counterpart, is in the film. And let me say, too, if you want to go to the web, you can see those excerpts. You can hear Wayne Morse. You can read the transcript. And that's warmadeeasythemovie.org.
Wow. You know, this is not just happening in California. I believe something like 45 other states are having budget problems. Oregon, we got through our legislative session, and they put together some sort of a budget. They had to make a lot of cuts. This is happening all over the country.
Yeah, I think so. It's very systemic, and it's going to a question of what the priorities are. You know, I when we started our discussion here, I had the quote about how the budget really is the skeleton of the state, no matter what smoke is being blown around. And that's where I think the stimulus package, while it may have moved in a good direction, was, I think, as Paul Krugman in the New York Times was warning 5-6 months ago, too small. And it also really avoided this role of the government. I don't think the role of the government is simply to try to prime the pump and get corporations to hire more people. As has been pointed out, the employment numbers are really a sort of a lagging indicator. The workers are the last to benefit from a supposed upswing. And, I mean, you could tell me and tell us, I mean, Per, your assessment of the economy in Portland. Do you see jobs being available or not, or how's it looking?
Well, the WANAs look very skimpy, put it that way. But, you know, you talk about the role of government. There are some people saying one thing the government can do, in fact, there's a woman in California, Ellen Brown, has written about this, is have a state bank that actually kind of floats its own bonds. Now, they've had one in North Dakota for 90 years, and North Dakota is one of the few states that apparently is not having any big budget problems. And what it means is that you can have state spending for, you know, these projects, but you don't have to get the money. You don't have to borrow the money from the banks to do it. So you save a lot on interest that way. Is there much interest in that down in California?
I've heard it discussed a bit in the North Dakota example that you give, which, as I understand it, you know, generally came out of a sort of Grange populist progressivism in the upper Midwest, what, a century ago. I think that people are looking for solutions, looking for leadership, and finding that there's a lot of efforts to bail out the boat from elected officials, understandably, and sort of stepping back and saying, where do we want to be in 5 years or 10 years, is not so common, and yet there's really a grassroots hunger for that sort of process.
Because I think this might be one issue that will sort of cut across the usual conservative liberal divide. I mean, conservatives seem interested in this too, and it's just I don't know. Like, something's got to give. I don't see how we can keep on spending so much money on the military and war and expect to have any kind of decent services at home.
Yeah, and the war, you know, has been shifting so that we're told about the pullback just yesterday from the cities by U.S. troops in Iraq, and yet a lot of troops are being added, 21,000 through the course of this year into Afghanistan. And as you mentioned a few minutes ago, being deployed out not to disengage, but to further engage. More killing, more bloodshed, more refugees. 90% of the money, as I mentioned, is going to military into Afghanistan, and yet we're creating more refugees and more suffering. And the demographics in Pakistan and Afghanistan are of tremendous poverty, and that's a context. I want to mention here, and I know we're just about out of time, but I'm working on an initiative where I'm be going with some other folks to Afghanistan. I can't give the details for security reasons, actually, but some, you know, high-ranking U.S. people will be part of a civic delegation, independent, to try to open other avenues of communication and information flow from the grassroots in Afghanistan to the United States. And so, long story short, if you'd like details and know how you can help, simply send me an email and I'll send you information. And that's norman@accuracy.org, just my first name and then accuracy.org.
Okay, thank you very much. You've been talking with Norman Solomon and about an issue that's not going to go away. It's going to be dragging this economy down for years and years and years unless something happens. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Pierre.